It wasn't much money, but enough to live relatively cheaply in Asia, and pay for the office and pay for some other things. Ended up not paying for the office anymore. We just shut it down, which was a big disappointment for me. I remember at the time I thought, wow, what kind of losers are we? Can't even keep our office open. Turns out as a blessing in disguise, as you know.
Hey, what's up, you guys? My name is Mikkel Korshovsky, and welcome to episode 30 of That Remote Show, where we hear from location-independent entrepreneurs and professionals so you can learn to quit the cubicle and live life on your terms. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by Justin Cook, the founder and CMO of Empire Flippers. I've been following Empire Flippers since I first got interested in online business because they are one of the premier online business brokerage sites in the world, having sold over $100 million worth of businesses, and they've been doing this since the very, very beginning, way back when in the early 2000s. And in this episode, Justin and I talked about how Empire Flippers was born from the ashes of their failing outsourcing company, how to manage a remote team and continue a forward trajectory even when you're not together all the time. And he even dished out some advice for those just getting involved in online business. And as someone who sees hundreds of businesses, this is advice that you shouldn't pass up. You can find all the resources mentioned in this episode at thatremotelife.com/episode30. That's episode spelled out with 30 the number. And if you guys enjoy this episode, consider leaving a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, you guys, I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. Here's Justin Cook from Empire Flippers. All right, well, Justin, welcome to the show, man. How you doing?
Good, man. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, before we started recording, I'm really excited to have you on because you're kind of like, you know, an OG of the online business world. And so I'm really excited to have you on and kind of like talk about your journey.
Cool, man. Yeah, excited to be here from Ho Chi Minh City. So we can talk about that a little bit. But yeah, I'm chilling here in Vietnam.
Yeah, absolutely. What is, to get us started, I know that you spend quite a bit of time in Vietnam and you're there right now. Why should somebody listening who is, you know, running an online business, why should they come to Ho Chi Minh and Vietnam in general?
Yeah. So one of the things I love about Saigon, as they call it here or whatever, is very vibrant city, very exciting city. Like it's moving, it's very electric, right? A very young population and a very hustle population. Unlike the north where it's a little closer to the party, so to speak, it's very entrepreneurial down here. And you know, there's a lot of people running businesses, starting businesses, co-working spots. Costs are great too. It's great financially. So if you're coming here, you know, making, you know, $2,500 a month, or you're coming here making, you know, $15,000 a month, you can find a lot of things to do. There's great restaurants, international restaurants, cuisine from all over the world. So you're definitely covered there. It's a great spot. I mean, it also helps. We have really good friends here. You know, my wife and I both have couple friends and individual friends. And so that's helpful too.
Would you say that it's a place that you'd go to more? Because I think there's like some places in the world that are really tailored for people that are just getting started or that are kind of like freelancers, or there's other places in the world that are like much better for like people who are running large businesses. Is there like, do you have a feel that Ho Chi Minh is one of those places where it tailors to one of those more than the other?
Yeah, I'd say it's probably maybe the second tier. So like Chiang Mai might be like you're just getting started, the costs are super low. Saigon's probably a little bit more than that. So it's probably next tier, closer to Bangkok, I'd say.
Yeah, the way that I heard Chiang Mai described once to me was like the freshman dorms of digital nomadism, which I thought was just like when I went there, I was like, yeah, that's what this is. You know, like everybody's like excited to meet. Everyone's just getting started, you know.
There's some of that. I'd say my first time here, I hated it, just to be clear. Like I was in the Boi Vien area, which is like the backpacker area. And I'm just not a backpacker. And so I was hanging out there, you know, hitting up the bars there and kind of hanging out. It's like a Khao San road for any of your audience familiar with Thailand. It's like a Khao San road on steroids. And I was like, that's what I thought the whole city was like. I thought it was just that. That's kind of where the expats or the tourists hang out. And and that was really all that was going on there. And I was like, I don't like this city. This is lame. And second time I went there, I went to like D1, which is kind of the main area. I had a much better time. And started to fall in love with it over time.
So was that one of the first places that you went when you got started sort of in the online world, or had you been doing it for a while before you got to Vietnam?
Yeah. So my business partner and I, you know, we'd worked for an SEO company in the US, and, you know, from a previously failed mortgage company we had, one of the things we did, we'd hired some virtual assistants, and we'd hired them, happened to be in the Philippines. And so working for this SEO company, you know, we were mid-level managers, and we had a bunch of people that worked for us, maybe 20-ish each. And we found a need to hire a lot more people. And as we were scaling, we said, look, we have a connection in the Philippines. Why don't we hire some remote staff that can do some of the like back office work at much cheaper rates? And so we pitched that to our bosses, our, you know, the COO and CTO, and they said, yes, let's do that. We started scaling that up. We started adding more and more Filipinos. We actually went to visit them, and we went back and we put together a plan to say, look, why don't we set up a company for you in the Philippines, and we'll become a partner. We'll become a third-party provider and basically, you know, leave our jobs. And they went for it. And so we left our jobs with a contract from our previous employer, and Joe and I both moved to the Philippines. Now, we'd been to Asia a few times before. I was in the Navy previously and had traveled, and Joe had spent some time in Europe. So we were somewhat familiar. We'd visited the Philippines once before just to visit the crew out there. So, but when we ended up moving there, it was different. I mean, you know, we sold our stuff. I put some of my stuff in storage and, you know, hopped on a plane with, you know, some huge luggage and was like, I'm changing my life, right? And flew halfway around the world to move to the Philippines. Now, I wasn't a digital nomad. I was just moving to the Philippines to run a company there. And so that's kind of how we got started with our kind of like latest, you know, iteration of what we were doing.
So when you were, I'm really curious how you kind of like managed this transition, right? So you're working, you're an employee of this company, essentially. Why did the company that you were working for, this SEO company, why did they want to go with you becoming essentially kind of like a contractor for them or a contracting company? Like, what were the benefits that you laid out to them so that they would go for it?
Yeah. So just cost benefit analysis. I mean, I think our team was probably 80, 90% as efficient as the crew in the States. And the costs were, I mean, we were probably paying 30, 40% of what an employee costs in the US. And so while they weren't interested in like laying their staff off, and we didn't push for that because it would have been our staff that we'd known and was working for us. There was a, you know, replace through attrition model. And so as people would leave the US company, we would add staff in the Philippines. And as the, you know, company continued to scale and we had new projects for them, we would add staff in the Philippines. And so, you know, when they went for the original model, like I stayed on as the director of operations at the company in the US, and Joe moved out to the Philippines. And we ran that for a few months. I think it was 3 months or so, 3 or 4 months. And, you know, I still had an office there, but I was just kind of like attached. I was, you know, a third party that worked closely with our previous employer, but I couldn't do it, man. I was like, my buddy and my business partner's out there kind of building our business in the Philippines. And we actually set up like a Philippines corporation and like kind of going through all the stuff, all the hassle, but all the fun too. And I was stuck just kind of like doing regular kind of office work in the US, and I hated it. And so I ended up leaving. My mentors were like, no, that's probably not a good idea. And I was like, I just don't care. For lifestyle and sanity purposes, I got to go. So.
And so then you went over to the Philippines with Joe?
Yeah. So he was already there 3 or 4 months. I went over in January 2010, and we started building our company. And so it was an outsourcing company, and we had a physical office. It wasn't like a remote company or anything. But we did back office kind of SEO work and local SEO work for our client, which is our previous employer. We started adding new clients. Throughout that year, though, in 2010, as we would add new clients, or this, no, this must have been, maybe it was 2009. I don't know. I'm forgetting the date. It's been a while. But as we started adding new clients, they started pulling back on what we were able to do. I think it was 2009, actually.
Like your original client that you had started working with.
Our previous employer. Yeah, it was 2009. And as we were adding new clients, they were pulling back. So we weren't really growing. Like we'd add like one client with 5 agents, and then they'd cut like 4 agents for us, right? And we'd add one client with 3 new agents, they cut 4. And so it was like, you know, we were kind of keeping afloat, but we weren't getting anywhere. And then finally, about not even a year in, they end up cutting everything. And so we were in a bit of a spot where we had, I think, maybe 12 to 15 people that were still had been working for them, and they were ready to cut us and cut them effectively. And we said, look, we got these good, smart, talented people. What do we do with them? Like, we shouldn't just let them go, but how do we afford them if they're not employed through a customer? We said, well, we could probably get them customers within the next 3 to 6 months. So let's keep them on. I think we had to let a few go, but let's keep on the best and the brightest, the ones we think we can get placed quickly, and find something for them to do. And so we tested a bunch of different projects and like what they could do. And, you know, a couple were, didn't work. They were loser projects. We couldn't make enough money to pay them their salary even. And then there was one that stuck. And the one that stuck was building these small niche websites that were monetized with something called AdSense. And, you know, AdSense is a Google platform, which basically, if you have a blog or a site or whatever, doesn't matter what it's about, but you can take their code and put it on your site, and there will be display advertisements. And, you know, if someone comes along, Google searches something and then finds your site, they click on an advertisement, they get paid anything from 2 cents to a dollar per click. And so we were able to build out these small sites, and I started doing it myself, and I built, you know, maybe not even a dozen, maybe 8 to 10. And we said, look, you know, that's kind of interesting. Maybe we can turn it a process that they can do now. So let's try that. And so we had them start building out these sites, and Joe and I were doing like the keyword research, and then we'd have them kind of do all the work to build them out. And it started working. So we started making a little bit of money, like, you know, maybe 30, 40 bucks the first month. And the next month it was maybe 200 bucks. And the month after that was like 500 bucks. And it wasn't a ton, but it like started to, we realized that we were onto like a nice little snowball of kind of money over time, that these would be nice little earners for us. And so we just kind of continued on, and we reached a point maybe 6 months in where we said, look, you know, I think we were down about $10,000 on the project. We had put money into it. We hadn't gotten the money back. We were maybe making, I don't know, 800 bucks, 1,000 bucks a month or something on it. But, you know, we were still out money. And we said, look, do we dump more money in this? Do we double down? Or do we, you know, just kind of like slow roll it out? Do we only do it on cash flow from here, which would be take a lot longer? And so we fought about it, Joe and I, my business partner, and we eventually came up with the idea of like, what if we could sell these, cash flow them today, and then roll that money into, you know, building more sites. So we won't take any of the money out.
Had you heard of anybody selling a website at this point like this, or was this just like a complete, like, we don't know if this is a thing?
No, I knew that buying and selling websites was a thing. We had bought a site, I think before I left for the Philippines, we bought a site called twitart.com, which we did Twitter backgrounds. This is a thing back in the day, early Twitter days. And people would like pay for backgrounds done. And we bought a company that was on a site called Flippa. And it was one of the first in the industry. It came out of a forum called SitePoint, and it was one of the first kind of like auction platforms for buying and selling sites. So we knew it was possible. We didn't know what the reaction would be though. So we listed some of these sites, and an example might be a site earning, you know, it's earning 50 bucks a month. It's been doing that for 4 to 6 months, let's say. And what we found is people were willing to pay some money for that, somewhere between $800 to $1,000 for a small little site making 50 bucks a month. And we had a particular process we used to get them sold and to get them more attention to sell for more. But we were amazed. I mean, I could take that, you know, it's making 50 bucks a month. It only costs me about 50 bucks to make. I can sell it for $800. I can then roll that into building a whole bunch more sites. And so we're able to snowball this kind of site creation and like kind of forego profit because it wasn't making much anyway, right? And just keep it kind of rolling through that. We were able to pay the bills to the outsourcing company still running and just kind of like let this project ride. And so we did that through 2010 and into 2011. And that became kind of like our model. We were known back then as the AdSense Flippers. That was our original name.
So even when you guys kind of, because that's when I first heard of you guys were AdSense Flippers, right? So at what point did you guys decide like, okay, this outsourcing business that we were doing up until now isn't the thing that we're going to pursue, and we're going to go into the AdSense Flippers business as our main thing?
So that was, I mean, We didn't. We basically kept them both rolling. So we had our outsourcing company still rolling in 2011. And we had the ads and slippers business. The outsourcing company, in our perspective, it kind of paid the bills. It wasn't much money, but enough to live relatively cheaply in Asia, and pay for the office and pay for some other things. Ended up not paying for the office anymore. We just shut it down, which was a big disappointment for me. I remember at the time I thought, wow, what kind of losers are we? We can't even keep our office open. Turns out as a blessing in disguise, as you know. So we were just running both, and ads and slippers, we said, look, you know, this isn't a moneymaker now, but we think it could be a big thing for us later. We think maybe this can be our profit and our outsourcing company can just pay the bills. And so we didn't take any money out of ads and slippers early on. We just kind of like let it snowball, which made it a lot easier. I know that if we were relying on ads and slippers to survive, like we wouldn't have been able to grow it as quickly because we'd have been pulling cash out for survival money, right? For salaries. Mm-hmm. And
I want to touch really quickly on, you kind of like mentioned it in passing that, you know, you guys had this like office and that there was a point when you guys actually had to like shut down the office and how it was really difficult at first. But was this even a thought at the time of you, at the time for you that like, hey, remote business and like businesses that are kind of like remote first are a thing and they can be even better? Or like, did you learn that later on just from like the need of running a business that way?
So we were pretty early days, right? So like, I mean, the first time we hired someone in the Philippines, there wasn't even, not even Upwork. There wasn't Odesk. Mm-hmm. There wasn't anything like that. No platform to hire someone for remote work. That wasn't even a thing. And so we found people in the Philippines on Craigslist, which was, yeah.
Like, I mean, Craigslist was, Philippines?
Yeah, like Craigslist Philippines. They had Craigslist worldwide, and that's how we got applications and hired people. So there was like a lot of this remote stuff that makes it so easy today wasn't even around. It started coming around in 2009, 2010, 2011. Like a lot of that stuff was super early. So no, I mean, when we moved to the Philippines, we weren't planning on a remote company. We were like, we picked up, planted our asses in the Philippines and said, we're going to run a Philippines company from the Philippines. And we figured, look, we can travel a bit. Like, you know, we'll take a week vacation here, or we can take a quick, it's easy to pop in over there. And we travel, but like, you know, we would be home base and office base in the Philippines. And so, you know, the idea of me going remote hadn't really crossed our minds. And it didn't for me personally until much, much later. Now, of course, everyone was kind of working from home and working remotely. But even through 2011, 2012, even into the Empire Flipper days, early Empire Flipper days, I was still, you know, working from home and not doing the travel thing. So
how did the... Going back to sort of like AdSense Flippers and like, how were you able to grow that into what is now Empire Flippers and is your current business?
So we were forced to change a bit. Our model for creating the sites, and it was a factory, right? It wasn't like we were, you know, super savvy, like site builders and, you know, SEOs. Like, we just weren't, right? We had a particular process and we built a machine around it, and that was working. And then we found problem in the machine. Basically, Google was no longer ranking our sites as well. They weren't as profitable. Whereas, you know, we used to take a $50 site cost on average, and inside 6 months, we'd, you know, get $200 back. Like, that's a sweet ROI. It became like, put $50 in and get a site worth about $60. 6 months later, we're like, oh, that's not nearly as good. Our margins are super slim. So rather than building sites, and we'd put this off for a year. Like, people would ask us, they said, look, you're building these sites. You guys are selling them on your own site. Like, we tried Flippa, but, you know, people were asking us, hey, I don't like going to Flippa because it's public and there's copycats. Can you guys sell to me direct? So we started selling direct through our site. And people asked because they knew we had a bunch of people buying our sites, right? And so other people building sites are like, hey, can we sell with you? And we're like, no way, because you're not going to take our customers and the money that we would make selling our sites. We're not willing to give that up. And so we resisted it. And then when we had this problem where our sites weren't nearly as profitable, we said, maybe let's revisit that idea. And so we let some people list and sell their sites. And I think we were selling at that time maybe, you know, like $2,000, $3,000 websites. And I think we let people list larger sites. So, you know, somewhere around the, you know, $10,000 to $30,000 range, we would let them list. And that's how we started.
Because currently, sorry to interrupt, but so currently just so that listeners know what's going on, is essentially you have AdSense Flippers, which is your website, and you are listing your websites that you are building on that website, right? And you essentially like let other people list on AdSense Flippers.
Yes, we did. We were building our own sites and we were listing our own sites. One of the things that that drew attention to us, though, I think was helpful, was we were super transparent as part of this like transparency movement that was going on in the early 2010s or whatever, where it's like, look, you know, here's the money we make, here's the success we have, here's the lack of success we have, here are the failures we've gone through and are struggling with today. Like, we were just super transparent about that stuff, and it really resonated with people. Also, you know, we didn't sell some ebook or course on how to do what we're doing. We didn't give away like 70% of the information and hold the other 30% back for, you know, subscribers or something. We weren't monetizing that at all. In fact, we put together a nice ebook and said, this is exactly our process. Here are the spreadsheets we use. Here's exactly what we do. Take it, go forth. Like, you know, it was very different than what was happening at the time. It was different enough to where people were like, wow, that's a purple cow, right? That's interesting. Mm-hmm. And so that helped drive that. And part of that was intentional too, because we knew if we drew enough people that were interested in building these sites, then some percentage, some subset of that group would be like, you know what? I don't want to build it. I'll just buy these sites from you. They make money now. I'd rather buy from you. And that proved to be true. So yeah, we had people buying sites from us, and then eventually allowed other people to list their sites with us as well. It was around this time, this is probably like 2012, maybe 2013, that we decided to rebrand Empire Flippers. A couple of reasons. One simple one was we couldn't get Google Apps on our thing with AdSense in the URL. They wouldn't let that. And then also we wanted to move beyond just AdSense sites. Like, we were only building AdSense sites, but if we're going to let other people list, we would allow for Amazon Associates sites, and we'd allow for, you know, eventually, you know, e-commerce businesses and other types of sites as well. And so, you know, we basically throughout maybe 2011, 2012, somewhere in that year, we stopped building and selling our own sites and started only brokering other sites, right? And we offered other services too. So we were still doing like content for people, keyword research packages. We tried a whole bunch of things. And we're kind of doing that. But the thing that really started to take off was the brokering of sites, like having a solid, you know, platform and connection that would, you know, match buyers and sellers of legitimate actual earning sites was super valuable. You know, there's a lot of people that would go to other platforms and, you know, would list anything or fake info. And there's a whole lot of scams going on. And the fact that we vetted and checked all of these listings and verified them was super helpful to buyers.
Yeah. I think something interesting that you guys do is that also, like, if people go to like the Empire Flipper site and they go to your marketplace, like, for me, it's like a kid in a candy shop, kind of. Like, you know, we were talking about this before we started recording, is like, I like to go and just browse and see what people are doing. And it's like really fun. And, you know, it is almost like gamified in a way, I want to say. So like, how did you guys like, was that an idea that you guys wanted to almost make it like a fun place for entrepreneurial people to browse? Like, was that like an idea when you guys were designing the marketplace?
Not early on. I mean, later on that came, but if you go check the Wayback Machine, for anyone's like a deep diver, I know I am, go do a Wayback Machine on Empire Flippers or AdSense Flippers in the early days, and you'll see this like ridiculous looking spreadsheet of a marketplace that had like a buy now, you know, highlighted link with like a PayPal link or something. There was no gamification. It was really straightforward. We've done some of that since then as we've kind of grown up a little bit. But yeah, early days, it was just, you know, whatever we can put up and you know, whatever works for our customers.
So how did you find, because I think finding sellers and people who are producing websites to most people is going to sound tough. But I think what would be even more difficult is actually, you know, in the kind of age, like the year span that you're talking about, is find people who are willing to buy these sites. How did you guys connect with like potential buyers of the websites?
Yeah. So there's a chicken and egg problem there, right? So it's like, if you don't have the buyers, the sellers don't really want to list with you. And if you don't have the sellers, the buyers aren't going to bother checking you out. So we solve that by being our own supplier initially. right? So like we didn't have an inventory problem only in as much as we couldn't build out the sites enough or couldn't get them earning enough, right? So because we own the supply chain of, and I'm not talking like an e-commerce guy, but like because we own the supply chain, we could just, you know, add more people, create more sites that earn more money, and we could meet demand. So we already had, we built up the buyers of our own sites, right? And so we, between, you know, our option, our best strategy there was to build up the buy side beforehand. And then it was just, we had quite a bit of buy side built up. Then it was just basically adding trusted and vetted sellers. So that was the process we took, just because of the path we took, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of people who kind of think about like the whole online business, digital nomad, location independent world, they almost have a picture of like them sitting in like an office or like, you know, in their Airbnb, just cranking work out on them, like by themselves. But I think something that you guys have done really well is like you guys are almost everywhere. Like you guys have like a really large network, I feel like. What has the benefit of doing that been, as sort of like building up that like in-person network?
Yeah, so it's different today, obviously, than it was back then. But let's go back, I don't know, like to 2014 or whatever, right? So we're the Empire Flippers, but you know, we still have a team in the Philippines. It was from our outsourcing days. We'd sold off the outsourcing company. We'd given up other revenue streams and profit streams. All of that was either sold, given away, or dumped. And we were just brokering online businesses, not building any of our own, just brokering. And we had, you know, a team in the Philippines of maybe a dozen or 12 to 15 people or something. And we had maybe a couple of us, maybe three or four of us on the Empire Flippers team from, you know, the U.S. And, you know, we had a model, it was called an apprenticeship model, where we'd bring people out, typically from the U.S., particularly early on, and we'd say, look, you know, you're going to fly halfway around the world, you're going to work for not that much money for the first 6 months, but your housing, your food, everything would be taken care of. We're going to give you $1,000 a month, but we're going to actually treat you like an apprentice. You're going to get a seat at the table. When we have these conversations, we have strategy sessions, like you're going to be a part of it all. And so we learned from our buddies at Tropical MBA, right, that that was a model that mm-hmm. was viable and would bring smart people. We thought it was dumb. We thought you would get like dumb people or like not great people to come out. And right, we met a few of their apprentices and we're like, oh, wow, these are sharp dudes. So why don't we try it out? So we went through the apprentice model and we brought a few people out and some of them stayed with us and said, look, I want to continue working with you. And so we did things to meet up and we do it today where I think back then we were meeting up 1 month from 1 month together in a kind of exotic location. And we do that 3 times a year. So we're spending 3 months a year together in, you know, Phuket and Manila and Boracay and Da Nang, like in these different locations. And so we get to have some work and some fun and some play together and get shit done. And then we kind of break up for, you know, the next 3 months or so, kind of do our own thing, go our separate ways. Now we don't do it quite as often. We do 2 weeks and we do it twice a year. So we actually just finished in Phuket. We were in Phuket last month and we were in a couple of villas on the hill and we had a team of about 40-ish there. Of our total 60, a little over 60 people on our team. We had about 40 something people show. We got to work and play and have fun together in Phuket for 2 weeks. Our next time will be next April in 2020 in Budapest, which we were talking about before the show. So, I mean, it's still really important for us to do that. But you know, now we don't, those are the big meetups. That's when we get most of our team together. But there's little small meetups where you got two or three people that travel together. So you'll have a couple of our sales guys that are traveling around together and you'll have, you know, four of us in Saigon and five of us in Manila and three or four people in Medellin. And so they're like little clusters where some of our team, some of the Empire Flippers hang out, but then also some of our customers are there too. So we get to hang out with them as well. So, I mean, it's a much bigger network and it's really nice if you travel a lot to kind of be a part of it. It's fun for us.
Yeah. You mentioned like at the very kind of like beginner days when you were like building these websites out that it almost was like factory like.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something that like, you know, SOPs is something that we hear a lot about in this space. How important has building up SOPs or standard operating procedures been for the success of, you know, Empire Flippers? And what are some of your tips that you might have for people that are in the position of currently building out their SOPs in their company?
So it's super important, like critically important to us. I mean, I'd say there's two things that were really very, very helpful in kind of growing our business. The first thing was we did a strategy session. We do this every quarter. And I'll get back to the SOPs. But strategy session number one, that's one of the critically important things. And we do it every quarter. And what that would be is it would be kind of like an overall, like long-term big hairy goal. Like, what do we want to be? What will our company look like in 3 to 5 years when we've crushed it, right? And so we'd lay out a few of those things and kind of like paint the picture of that. And then we'd work backwards. We'd say, okay, what do we need to do this next year to hit that 3 to 5 year goal? Okay, so we want to get this accomplished in a year. Great. Now, but let's break that down into quarterly chunks. What do we need to do in Q1 and Q2 and Q3 to hit that? And then, so every quarter we'd review, did we hit our goals for the previous quarter? And, you know, what are we doing for this next quarter to hit our annual goals, which are to hit the big goals? So every quarter we do the strategy meeting, and I can go back to, I think it's 2011, 2012, and like look at all the documents we'd had. Now, the first ones were much smaller and much shorter meetings. Now it can take, you know, upwards of 6-7 hours with our management team. But like, that's been something that like, it gives us a point in the future that we're heading towards. It's always a moving point. So like what we had written, you know, as a big hairy goal 3 or 4 years ago, a lot of those we've accomplished, and like they're different now, right? But we're always like heading in a direction. Sometimes it's not a straight path. Sometimes it's windy and we zag and we zag, but having that long-term goal has been critically important. The other thing that's been really important is the SOPs you mentioned. And, you know, that the reason that's important is because of the kind of factory approach. As you scale a business, you know, like you have a bunch of stuff in your head. And a lot of entrepreneurs, probably some of the ones listening to this, are like, you know, they think, oh, well, no one can do everything that I do. And that's not true. It's only true if you keep that shit in your head and you don't actually write out processes for it. Like if you're able to like say, okay, here's one thing I do, here's another process I do, and you're able to like kind of document that to where someone else can follow it, then yeah, well, that's how you train other people to do your work. That's how you take what's in your head and spill it out into a process that other people can follow. And if you're going to scale your team, like that's just an absolute requirement. You have to be able to do that.
What are some of like the tips or tools that you have to that like enable you to build out those SOPs within the company?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter too much.
Or do you keep it all in Google Docs? Or
yeah,
like so how do you structure
it? We use something called Suite Process, but which is kind of cool. And it's like modular, so you can remove modules and the sharing permission stuff. But you don't have to do that. I mean, you could do it in Google Docs probably almost as easily. Making sure that someone's responsible for every particular SOP and that they're updated at somewhat regular intervals. I mean, this needs to be a living document. It's particularly important if you bring on a new round of hiring. So that's a really good time to review them. If you don't have a set, like review them quarterly or semi-annually, then before you hire new people, you better make sure those screenshots are up to date, make sure the process is still the way that it is. So yeah, I mean, we have them across our department from the marketing team to the vetting team to the migration team. And they have anything from a simple 3 or 4 step process to a 25-step process, depending on the job.
Yeah, I want to transition a little bit because I think people are dying to hear what you think about, you know, actually building out websites and like selling businesses and stuff like that. Because you know, you're kind of an expert since you see so many of these like businesses come through. What do you think? You know, like you said, AdSense was very popular before. I'm sure dropshipping was kind of like a really popular thing afterwards and affiliate websites. What do you see right now as being like a very popular sort of website that is in demand for these people that are looking to buy online businesses?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because for obvious reasons, like I see stuff later in the cycle. Right. So let's say that there's something that people are working on today, like they're just getting started with this and it's going to crush it in 2 or 3 years. No one's selling those businesses yet because it's literally just starting off. So I won't even hear about it for a year or two. And I won't even see one of those businesses for sale for 2 to 3 years if they're starting it out today. So we're pretty late in the cycle for things. So in terms of like cutting edge on what types of monetizations are out there, I can't tell you that. I can tell you what's selling well today, and I'll mention that. We're selling a lot of Amazon FBA businesses, particularly the 7-figure deals. So Amazon FBA businesses, the deals, the FBA businesses that go, that sell best, are multi-channel. They have a lot of SKUs. They're established. They've got, you know, a great following. They've got a great brand. They're not just selling the same old products everyone else is selling. We sell just e-commerce in general. There's quite a bit of that. We still sell some drop shipping sites, not the Alibaba, you know, pick any product drop shipping, like, again, more brand heavy. We still do the Amazon Associates site. So there's a lot of Amazon Associates sites that are selling. What I haven't seen lately, and I kind of miss them, is the lead gen sites. So we used to do a lot of local lead gen type sites that were monetized via Campus Explorer or like Quinn Street. Those were hot a couple of years ago, and I haven't seen those much recently. I think it's a fantastic business model. I've talked about another podcast, but if you want to check it out, I think those are cool sites.
Yeah, if you had to like, you know, if you had to like start a site right now or like an online business that is, you know, one of the ones that you guys would sell later on, like what would you yourself jump into right now?
What would I jump into? I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you want physical product, FBA for sure. Although, you know, there's kind of a mode around that now because a lot of people that started in FBA, like they got a bunch of reviews and they built up a brand. Like it's harder to do that from scratch now. So starting in FBA, you can do it. People do it, make money, but it might be a little more difficult. Going back to the lead gen thing, I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of for-profit educational institutions in the US, right? And they charge people a hell of a lot of money. And they're willing to pay good money for leads for those customers that they can find. And so, you know, work with Campus Explorer or Quinn Street, do some like local SEO, which is much easier to get ranked for. It's a lot easier to get ranked for like nursing programs in Sacramento, California than it is like nursing programs, you know, countrywide. So yeah, that's probably the kind of approach I would take. You know, they're not going to be killing it seven-figure businesses for the most part. They're probably going to be somewhere between, you know, $30,000 and $200,000 sites. But, you know, they could be kicking out somewhere between, you know, $1,000 to, you know, $8,000 a month in profit, which is not too bad.
Yeah. What about the complete opposite end of things? You know, are there certain, you know, like monetization, you know, tactics that you guys do not like sell on Empire Flippers whatsoever for like whatever reason? Like what are those? And then what are the reasons that you don't sell them for?
Yeah. So we don't do anything illegal. We generally, so like anything drug related, anything, yeah, gang related. I mean, things that are like clearly off, we wouldn't do. If it can't be sold on Amazon often, we, you know, we probably wouldn't sell that business. We don't do porn or adult. And sometimes that's in a gray area where it's not really porn, but it's like uncomfortable for like our team. Or we're just like, you know what? We don't, there's no reason for us to do that. And there's a whole list of things that we have in the vetting process where we don't allow sites that are on a serious negative trajectory, for example. So, you know, we actually charge money for people to list their business with us. Now, we don't make any money on that deal. It's not a real earner for us, but it's a filtering process because if we didn't, we'd have a gazillion people submitting their listings. And so even the people that pay the listing fee, I think we only allow about 20, 25% to get listed on the marketplace. So it's a pretty rigorous vetting process that we put them through. And sometimes it's looking for things that can't be verified. So if we can't verify the earnings or the traffic for a, you know, a variety of reasons. We can't verify the information, then we won't let them list. Not because it's a scam, but because it could be and we can't verify it. Other times it's like, look, we've tried to list these before and it's just like our audience isn't buying it. Like,
what are some of those examples?
Yeah. So I think the Alibaba drop shipping businesses right now. So the ship from China drop shipping businesses like have not sold well for us. We're actually doing a test right this minute. I don't know when this published or when your listeners listen to this, but we're doing a test like right this minute for the best examples of those. We're going to try to take a couple on and just test that hypothesis. Like buyers didn't want it before the last year or two. Is that still true today? Let's test it. So we're going to get a couple of them, put them on the marketplace and see if they sell. If they don't, then we'll go stick with our process now. So we're constantly testing and reevaluating kind of like what the market's looking for. Like we just recently allowed, you know, marijuana businesses to be sold. I mean, there's plenty of them in the US. It's legal for the most part. So we're like, look, I don't particularly care. I'm fine with it. So it's fine. You know, let them list. So, I mean, yeah, we're just constantly making adjustments to our process depending on, you know, how the market is changing.
Yeah, in mentioning your buyers, I think you guys have this like really cool thing on the website where you kind of mention, hey, here's a business that's up for sale and here's the like buyer profiles that it would fit. What are some of those buyer profiles that make up, you know, your buyer pool like mostly?
Yeah, so we did this on, it was kind of a lark. I mean, we thought it through and we were like, you know, what, you know, because we get this question asked a lot, like, what does your buyer look like? And I was like, well, we don't have just one. Like, we really don't. And so I can't just tell you what our buyer looks like. I can explain what buyers will look like. And so we decided to do that in a funny way where we put personas to them. So, you know, you have someone like a newbie norm, right? And a newbie norm is a guy that's kind of brand new to this whole thing, wants to see if it's even real, can even make money on the internet, you know, that kind of person. They've never really done anything before. They're just kind of getting their feet wet and trying it out. You have someone like a DIY Dave. DIY Dave is like, look, I want a tinker. I want a site I can play with that I can do maybe some conversion rate optimization with. I want to test monetization methods. I want to do some split testing, things like that, right? It really wants to get in there and play with it, maybe on a beach in Bali somewhere. You know what I mean? Like they want it, but they want to be able to work on it. You have someone like a portfolio Paul that probably already owns a few businesses, owns a few sites, is like looking to add sites to that portfolio that may have some synergies with, you know, the other websites that he already has, is looking to grow that out. You have strategic Sally who is looking for a business that in particular works with a business she already owns or is considering purchasing separately, where she can kind of combine efforts and make a 1+1=3 scenario. So yeah, we got a whole bunch of different buyer personas. And the funny thing about that is we did that, I think, in a podcast, and it really resonated with people. They were like, oh my God, I'm a newbie norm, but I want to be a portfolio Paul. And I would get emails, this is earlier days, I get emails from people and they're like, oh, you know, I connect with this one or I want to be that. And so we kind of incorporated that into our actual business. And what you're seeing on the marketplace where you see like a buyer profile is kind of just a leftover, a holdover from like the early days when we did those profiles and people thought they were cool. I still think there's a lot of validity to them, which is kind of why we use them. And it's kind of fun for people to, you know, tell us kind of where they're at and what they're looking for.
Yeah, obviously, you know, I think people can also probably fit in multiple ones, right? Based on like where they are. But do you feel like there is one of those profiles that are represented more in your buying pool?
I mean, there's other things about those profiles. There's a type of person. So we, on the buy side, it's heavily American. Whereas like our sellers, it's not even primarily American, but our buyers definitely are. It's not uncommon for me to hear a story that's similar to kind of like where I have been, where you're sitting in a cubicle or an office, maybe you're a mid-level manager, you're a senior person in the company, and you've had a career and you make good money and you have some money put away, but you just can't stand the rat race anymore. And so that's a particular buyer that I resonate with, where they're like, look, I want to get away from my job. I want to start buying up some assets. I'll work on the side. I'll work weekends, whatever. Let me just kind of build these, run these for 3 to 6 to 9 months. And then I'm leaving my job and I want to spend time at home with my family and I want to be around for my kids growing up. And I want to be able to take my kids to school and pick them up every day. Or maybe I want to goof off to Bangkok or I want to fly to Prague and, you know, drink beers with some Czech people, you know, whatever. Like, people have different goals and dreams, but that one resonates with me. I like that one. One thing we're seeing right now, which is really interesting at a higher level, is like the funds. So it used to be a couple of years ago, most of the private equity groups we talked to were like, look, we're looking for, in terms of value, like a business value at 10 million or more. Right. And then there were some that would go down to like 5 million, which is generally larger than the business we'd done up to that point. But now we're seeing them come down into like the low to mid 7 figures, and they're looking to buy businesses there. In fact, a lot of new funds are popping up and they're trying really creative and interesting ways to kind of build these portfolios. So I know a fund that they only buy 100,000 to 1 million, and they're looking value businesses. And they're looking particularly at FBA. I know another fund that's taking kind of like the big business public, and it's got some smaller businesses kind of attached to it that have some benefit, and then wants to take that company public and then buy other companies based on that new valuation. So if you're buying at a multiple of, I don't know if this is over your audience's head or not, but if you're buying at a multiple of 2-3x and you're plugging it into a publicly traded company that's at like 8-9x, like your valuation just shoots through the roof, right? And you can just print money with that. So like, those are some interesting things that are happening in the space that it's early days, but we're a part of. And I don't know which of these fund models, and there's a whole bunch of different ones, I don't know which is going to work, but if one of them works, I'd expect a ton of money to flow into the space, right? Because if someone can prove that model out and they're scaling it and they're adding new investors and they're putting more funds together that are similar to the last one, it's working, like, you know, there's people looking for yield and they will latch on to that and absolutely dump money in the industry.
Yeah. Having been there kind of, like I said, like in the beginning, you know, like you talked about, like when you got started, this wasn't even like a thing, and kind of like having gone through the entire, you know, movement, where do you see this going, right? Like, what do you think this whole world of the like remote work, location independent, online business, like, where do you think that's going to be 5 to 10 years from now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not going to be uncommon for most people to be working remotely, at least part-time. I think remote companies are going to be much more likely. In terms of kind of our industry, of the kind of buying and selling of online businesses, I think that's going to continue to grow. I think more and more people are looking to, you know, buy their own business and run their own business. I think as these funds kind of mature and find interesting ways to portfolio and package businesses, and if they can take these businesses and roll them up for much larger valuations, I think there'll be a lot more of that, more serious money coming into the space. I see it, we're really working on a new asset class, and that's where I really see this going. Is, you know, how you may right now invest in all different kinds of things. And you can log into your dashboard and see how your investments are doing. One of the directions we want to go is we want you to log into your Empire Flippers dashboard and be able to invest in multiple operators and businesses along the way. So I've got 40,000 in this online business. I've got 60,000 over here. And you can monitor your returns over time and kind of like see how that's doing. Maybe you plug it into your Mint or your personal capital. I think that'll be a really interesting play for the industry. And I think that's probably where we're heading in the next 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. That's super exciting to me. I think that'll be like really, you know, like fun way to like play around with this stuff. But thank you so much, man, for being on the show. And, you know, in wrapping up, if people are pumped about what you're talking about and they want to like, you know, check you guys out or you personally, you know, where can they find you?
Cool, man. Well, we got a podcast, Empire of the Risk podcast. We interview some cool people. If you want like a real breakdown on buying and selling businesses and kind of the industry, check out Web Equity Show. I run that with a friend of ours, Ace Chapman. And then just say hi to me on Twitter @Empire of the Risk.
Cool, man. Well, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having the show, man. Appreciate it.